This podcast is brought to you by fin24.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Off the Record. I'm Colleen O'Dea, editor of FinWeek. And in the studio, I have Mark Ashton of Fin24 and on the line, Victor Clark. To start off today, I would like Vic to explain to the readers the very interesting but highly technical story he has in FinWeek this week about the Rand. Vic, over to you.
Okay, let's start with this perception. Okay, the currency is too strong, the Rand is too strong, it is hurting the exporters, it is hurting the farmers, they always complain, it's hurting manufacturing, etc. And then people say the government and the Treasury or the Reserve Bank, the Treasury should do more to get the Rand weaker or to regulate the exchange rate. You know, people were even talking about taxes on inflow of money and things like that. In the latest MPC report, that's a monetary policy report of the Reserve Bank, there was just a few words, a small little mention by Jill Marcus, who said, we will continue to look with the help of National Treasury, that's the receiver of revenue, at all the possibilities around this total issue, but we will also have to look at the following thing, as well as the availability of resources to do so. In other words, do we really have the resources to continue to support the Rand or to keep the Rand perhaps weaker than what it would be without this intervention?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, let's try and do some sort of a calculation of what is the cost to Treasury and to the Reserve Bank to support, not to support our currency, to try and keep our currency weak. I'm used to say support because that is what we had to do in the years 1980 to 1995. Try and keep the exchange rate of the Rand at around about 7.25 and stop it from going to 6.50 or even lower than that. We started adding up the various items there and the various accounts. There's three accounts that one can identify. Well, one is the valuation account of our foreign exchange reserves. The second is the interest rate loss that we're suffering on our foreign exchange reserves of about $42 or $43 billion that we're having at the moment. Remember, we're earning less than 0.25% interest on those things, and on this side, we're paying about 6% interest. And we also look at the losses that the Treasury suffer from the huge amount of money, rand deposits that it has to keep with the Reserve Bank to sterilize the impact of all this excessive inflow of foreign money.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to say much more than this. People must go buy the FinWeek and read it. I'm just going to say to the people the guesstimate of what the cost was for the past 18 months is 100 billion for that.
Yeah.
End of my story.
Yeah, Vic, I agree with you. I think it's the type of story that lends itself to reading it and getting your teeth into it, because it's so technical. It's not something that one can discuss on radio, on a podcast, or whatever. So, yeah, as you say, people should get out there and buy FinWeek.
Okay.
Okay.
And please, that money is not available to all of a sudden pay higher salaries for people that are running around in the streets of at the moment. Although it did cost us that much, it could not have been that. You can't really spend it on higher salaries.
Yeah. On that note, Vic, what is your guesstimate? What does the strike cost the economy per day?
You know, I don't always agree with these things like that. If you stay away from work one day, you're actually costing your employer so much, because if you really work a little bit harder the next day, and then it doesn't cost him anything at all. And the same with all the mining things, you know, if a mine stops working for 3 days, they're very eager to multiply the tons milled by, you know, and get some sort of a rand value to that strike. And then in a couple of days' time, in any case, you know, because of higher production that follows that, you recover that amount. So I'm not that keen on putting a value on it. It is a very bad thing for a country to have something like this. But you must remember that all countries going through the phase that we have, that we're still a manufacturing country, we're still a mining company, a country, and we still have some very political issues, not the old white-black political issues, but political issues within the government that still has to be resolved. I'm to a certain extent sympathetic to the strike and say it is something that we need to just to do a little bit of bloodletting in the country at the moment, but it is costing us a lot.
Do you think, Mark or Vic, that the strike had something to do with the bloodbath on the JSE, the sentiment that it created in the country?
I would say no, because that the correlation that the JSE goes up and down every time that there's a bloodbath on Wall Street. So there, housing sales, that was very bad, new and existing housing sales earlier this week that we announced that side, that immediately had an effect on exchange, on markets across the world. I mean, as the world was turning clockwise, or was it anti-clockwise, I don't know, markets were just dropping. And then we have a strike and it doesn't affect us at all on the JSE. But American, the sales of American houses did affect us very severely.
And I mean, a lot of those stocks also get their prices out of London, you know, for your old mutuals and your Anglos. So I think that had a, there was probably a bigger influence on it.
Okay. Thanks, Vic. Okay, Mark, let's talk about this week's cover story. It's about the HSBC Nedbank deal. Well, it's not a deal yet, but pending deal. And the cover words are, unlikely pairing and banking will never be the same again. Do you agree with the sentiment of it? That's an unlikely pairing?
Yeah, I think it's a very unlikely pairing from a, and it's actually been, it's been discussed quite a lot, is the Nedbank culture versus, say, the HSBC or even the Standard Chartered, which was another bank that was linked to them. I mean, they're very big, aggressive foreign banks that bring a very different culture to particularly a bank like Nedbank, which I think prides itself on a lot of the softer issues, which would be things like your environment and your and sustainability. And I think maybe it's going to be a very interesting culture shock for the type of people within Nedbank versus what their international masters will probably expect of them when if and when the deal goes ahead.
Yeah. But do you think it will benefit Nedbank?
Tough one to say. I think Nedbank has to do something. I think that's been a criticism that's been leveled at them for many years now. They've always been the perennial underperformer in terms of return on equity for shareholders. I mean, there's been the speculation which has kind of kept the share price up and interested. But I think they're going to have to do something to try and sort of reinvigorate the franchise a bit and try and help it make up some of its lost, you know, some of the market share that it's been battling to gain.
Mm-hmm. And for HSBC, do you think it's a very long-term view from them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, somebody pointed out to me the other day that when ICBC came into Standard Bank, I mean, they bought into that company at 136 rand a share, and the share is now trading 100 rand a share. And you know, the Chinese shareholders there haven't really seen it as a step backward. It's simply been, it's a long-term view. We'll put the money there. We'll build the platform from which to operate. And I think the same can probably be said of a potential investment in Nedbank as well. I mean, it does give you sort of the gateway into Africa. I mean, one of the criticisms that was leveled against Nedbank specifically is that it doesn't have a strong African franchise. It's got a bit of an alliance with Ecobank, which I think is represented about 5 or 6 countries. But it's not enough to say, brilliant, if we plug into Nedbank, we then get to plug into the rest of the continent, which is, which I think is tricky to, you know, how do you weigh it up? Does it mean you're going to put all the money into Nedbank South Africa and then still work on building the franchise within Africa itself? Tough one to call.
Yeah. Did you also see the second story within the cover story about that South African banks are actually a victims of their own success?
Yeah, I mean, I looked at it, and it's interesting. I mean, I think they've just gone through such a boom period. I mean, we were just chatting about it off air. You know, when a bank comfortably reports profits of 12 billion rand in a bad year, you know, it makes you realize just how big these businesses are and how much free cash and how essentially they've just been fantastic money machines for people for the last decade. And it's going to be quite interesting to see, and I think Michael Jordan touched on it, he's the CEO of FNB, about the impact that technology is playing on these banks.
Correctly.
You know, you've got mobile devices, you've got the internet, why do you need somebody to go into a branch these days to transact? And what was that was traditionally a revenue line for them was dealing with a service consultant cost you X. the same service now costs you 80 cents or whatever an SMS costs you.
Mm-hmm. But they have started closing down some of the branches on in the rural areas, haven't they?
Yeah, and definitely ABSA, and I think FNB have tried to consolidate some of those branches. I think it's just scale and volume. Although FNB have indicated that they are keen to expand. I think it's 52 in the next year or something. So, I mean, there's still some expansion happening. I don't know if that's just a function of where the growth is happening across South Africa.
The article also states that they are very poor short-term propositions. Being an investor yourself, would you invest in some of our four banks now?
Probably not. I think I don't think that the prospects for them are particularly exciting. I mean, I think you'll always get the steady dividend out of them. But they've got to work quite hard for business now. And I mean, you know, somebody used the example of Capitec again. Yes, it's been a fantastic success story, but you know, Capitec is able to help you draw cash directly through a retailer now. You can go to your Checkers or ShopRite or whatever, draw cash through that, and that's the same service that again a bank is charging for, and Capitec's kind of plugged into the retail market that way. And I think that, you know, it shows that the competition is really starting to bite at them. Microlenders, big balance sheets for the likes of Capitec and Able. You know, there's a lot of competition happening within that sector. That means banks are going to have to work quite hard.
Mm-hmm. I see that the Nedbank share price picked up about 6% after announcement of the prospective deal. Would you consider Nedbank?
Probably not. And I mean, one thing that was quite interesting is the size of the stake that HSBC is looking for. They're looking for nearly 70%. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you've only got 30% in free float, it doesn't necessarily. I think you're kind of locked into whatever you don't have any of that speculative. If the growth isn't there and there's nothing to really speculate around, you know, future of it and growth prospects or opportunities for other corporate action, it becomes, you know, it's not the most exciting proposition, methinks.
Okay. All right, that is the cover story of FinWeek out today.
Maybe just before we sign off for this week, this was your last issue, and I think from all of us on Fin24 and FinWeek, we just want to extend a thank you for all of your contribution to us and teaching us as we've gone along. I think you've had to put up with a whole lot of new faces in the last 4 or 5 years, and it is hugely appreciated.
Oh, thank you so much,
Mark. And
we hope
you enjoy your, wherever you go from here.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'll miss a lot of you. Thanks. Bye-bye.